Final one to go. And next week, same place, same time. You know, see it. It's all about CKUT 90.3 FM. It's all about the positive vibe. Love one on the scene.
KUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune in to the Prison Radio Show every other week on Tuesdays between 6 and 7 p.m. To get involved with Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Yes, rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means.
Do you?
It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a man. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. On today's show, you'll be hearing edited audio from a workshop about the prison system that happened as part of the Concordia...
Hello and welcome back to the Electronic Intifada's live stream for Wednesday, April 10th. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with my colleagues Ali Abunima, Asa Wynn-Stanley, John Elmer, and Tamara Nassar. It's day 187 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. We have another packed show for you today, including a discussion with journalist and author Anthony Lowenstein about Israel's use of tech, surveillance, and artificial intelligence during the past 6 months of its genocide in Gaza. And later on in the program, of course, a full roundup of videos from the Palestinian Armed Resistance with John Elmer, including detailed analysis of the complex resistance ambush that chased the Israeli military from Khan Yunus and Hezbollah's downing of Israel's flagship drone over Lebanon. But first, some of the news that we've been covering at the Electronic Intifada. Palestinians across the Gaza Strip gathered to mark the end of Ramadan today on Eid al-Fitr. In Jabalia refugee camp, where every single one of the mosques have been destroyed by Israel over the last 6 months, Palestinians recited the Eid prayers outside in the pouring rain. The Israeli army withdrew most of its ground forces from the southern Gaza Strip over the weekend, but Israeli airstrikes have not stopped across Gaza. On Monday and Tuesday, Israel bombed areas in Deir al-Balah and Maghazi and Nuseirat refugee camps. Hatem al-Gamri, the mayor of Maghazi, was killed in an Israeli airstrike on the camp. The Palestinian Health Ministry in Gaza reported that since October 7th, approximately 34,000 Palestinians have been killed and 76,000 injured, with many thousands more missing or buried under the rubble. Earlier today, Israel targeted and killed three sons and grandchildren of Hamas Politburo chief Ismail Haniyeh in an airstrike on their car near Shati refugee camp. In Khan Yunus, after the Israeli army withdrew, activist and journalist Maha Husseini tweeted that, quote, not a single home isn't bombed, not one building isn't scorched. Walking through the neighborhoods, you cannot help but sense Israel's palpable desire for revenge against an entire population. Palestine Red Crescent Society staff were able to survey the damage Israeli forces had inflicted on Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunus, the medical organization's headquarters, after Israel's 43-day siege forced the hospital to suspend all services on March 26th. The Palestine Red Crescent reported that Israeli occupation forces destroyed PRCS vehicles, including ambulances, that were parked in front of Al-Amal Hospital before the soldiers withdrew from the area. They also stated that, quote, after the withdrawal of Israeli occupation forces from the vicinity of Palestine Red Crescent Society Al-Amal Hospital in Khan Yunus on April 7th, the extent of the significant damage to the hospital's facilities became evident. The occupation forces raided the hospital, resulting in the destruction of medical equipment, nursing rooms, intensive care units, the ophthalmology department, the emergency operations room, and ambulances. During the Israeli siege on the Al-Amal Hospital, Palestine Red Crescent Society staff said that one of their colleagues, a nurse named Mohammed Abed, was fired on by Israeli soldiers when evacuating medical teams and patients. For about 2 weeks, quote, his fate remained unknown as the ambulance crew was prevented from transporting him. Mohammed Abed's body was found on Sunday, quote, identified through the uniform of the Palestine Red Crescent Society, which was supposed to provide him with protection. They said that Mohammed was dedicated to his work, continuing to provide medical services to patients and the wounded despite the hospital siege, which lasted 43 days. Rest in peace, Mohammed, the Palestine Red Crescent Society stated. With Mohammed's killing, the Red Crescent added, the number of their personnel killed by Israeli forces in Gaza while performing their humanitarian duties has risen to 16. Over the weekend, Palestinian civil defense crews began retrieving bodies and body parts from the grounds in and around Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, following the two-week slaughter carried out by Israeli forces before they withdrew last week. The Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor reported that forensic, ambulance, and civil defense crews uncovered bodies from pits dug by the Israeli army in the hospital courtyard. Gaza's civil defense says that more than 400 bodies have been recovered since the Israeli army's retreat. Motassem Salah, director of the Gaza Emergency Operations Center, told Agence France-Presse that, quote, the stench of death is everywhere as a bulldozer went through the rubble and rescue workers pulled decomposed bodies from the sand and ruins. Speaking to the AFP agency, Salah said that Gaza lacked the forensic experts needed to help identify the dead or determine what had happened to them. So they are relying on the expertise of delegations with the World Health Organization and the UN's Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. They are trying, quote, to identify the decomposed bodies and the body parts that were crushed from wallets and documents, he told AFP. Salah added that the psychological impact of this unwatchable process on the families is unbearable, AFP reported. The United Nations stated that, quote, following six attempts to reach Al-Shifa Hospital that were either denied, delayed, or impeded by Israeli authorities during the two-week assault, the World Health Organization reported that the scale of devastation has left what was once the largest and most important referral hospital in Gaza completely non-functional, with substantial efforts needed to clear unexploded ordnance, assess the potential for making the facility safe and accessible, and evaluate the functionality of vital equipment such as ventilators and CT scanners. Most hospital buildings, including the emergency department, the surgical and maternity ward buildings, and the neonatal intensive care department, were extensively damaged or burnt, along with most of the equipment, beds, incubators, the oxygen plant, and other assets. As a result, according to the World Health Organization, northern Gaza has been left without any CT scanning capabilities, significantly reduced laboratory capacity, and only one source for medical oxygen production at Kamel Adwan Hospital, quote, severely compromising effective diagnosis, which will increase avoidable deaths. COGAT, the bureaucratic arm of Israel's occupation, boasted this week that it had increased the number of international humanitarian aid trucks being allowed to enter Gaza and announced that it had opened both the Ashdod port and the Erez crossing in northern Gaza for humanitarian aid deliveries. The announcement came after Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and U.S. President Joe Biden spoke on the phone following Israel's drone strike on the World Central Kitchen workers last week. However, the United Nations confirmed on Tuesday that the Erez crossing, quote, remains closed, contrary to what Israel promised 4 days ago. Erez crossing and the Ashdod port are still not operational, despite what was announced, the UN added. Quote, at the moment, Israel only allows trucks to pass through Rafah and to a lesser extent through Kerem Shalom, both in the south. The spokesperson for the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs explained why the truck entry figures reported by the Israeli government differ from those reported by the UN. Israel counts the trucks it inspects and lets in, and the UN counts those that arrive at its warehouses. Between these two steps, the spokesperson said, there are problems. First, the trucks entering are half-loaded, a requirement Israel has imposed. They then force Egyptian drivers to unload and leave before Palestinian trucks and drivers can pick up the cargo, something that often does not happen until the next day and makes it impossible to compare day-to-day figures. UN trucks are loaded and accounted for as fully loaded, the UN stated. Some of the humanitarian aid trucks that are making it into the Gaza Strip are carrying much-needed medications and medical supplies to partially functioning hospitals or medical clinics and field hospitals. But physicians say that the medicine and food is only a drop in the bucket compared to what is really needed to address Israel's engineered crisis of starvation and bodily harm due to 6 months of this genocide. This is Wissam Al-Sekni, media director at Kamel Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza, speaking to Al Jazeera on Monday.
Shipment of medicines yesterday is not enough compared to the urgent needs of citizens due to the high rates of malnutrition among them, along with the shortage of some food and medicines for these children, whom you can see in the background behind me in the children's nursery. Most of the children come into the hospital with malnutrition, especially premature babies, due to the malnutrition of the mother, and that affects the mother and other patients.
I'm not only suffering because of her, but also because of all the children. Every child is suffering from malnutrition, and every day we lose 5 or 10 children.
That was Wissam Al-Sekni of Kamel Adwan Hospital speaking to Al Jazeera. Legendary Palestinian activist, poet, and novelist Waleed Dakka died in an Israeli prison this week after Israeli authorities refused to release him after he completed his 37-year sentence and was battling myelofibrosis, a rare form of bone marrow cancer. Dakka, who is 62, was born in the Palestinian city of Baqa al-Gharbiya in present-day Israel, where he was a citizen. He was arrested by Israeli occupation forces in March of 1986 for allegedly participating in armed resistance as a member of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, a leftist political party. Israeli authorities sentenced him with a maximum imprisonment term of 37 years. As of 2023, Dakka completed that sentence. But in 2017, Israel extended his detention by two years on the grounds that he had smuggled phones into his cell with the assistance of a lawmaker from the Knesset, the Israeli parliament. Adamir, the Palestinian prisoners' rights group, said last year that Dakka was, quote, in dire need of urgent medical attention. The Israeli prison service doctor assigned to treat Dakka prescribed medications that severely compromised his immune system and increased his risk of infections. Ademir called for his immediate release from prison, but Israel refused and ordered his release date for 2025. Particularly cruel is the Israeli prison service's policy of refusing to give Dukkha's body to his grieving family, withholding his body until his 2025 sentence is over. Last year, my colleague Tamara Nassar wrote that, quote, Dukkha, who spent the majority of his life in Israeli prison, authored multiple books while incarcerated, including a children's book on the Israeli occupation of Palestine titled The Oil's Secret Tale. Israeli prison authorities punished him for it, placing him in solitary confinement. In 1999, Dukkha married his wife Sana Salama from prison, and in 2020, the couple had a daughter, Milad, who was conceived with sperm smuggled from prison. On Monday, the Israeli police raided Walid Dukkha's home and the condolences tent, assaulted his family, arrested several mourners, and confiscated the tent. Ademir stated on Monday that, quote, today Dukkha departs, leaving behind a message he wrote in his 36th year inside the occupation's prisons, saying, I will continue to love you all, for love is my humble and sole victory over my jailer. And finally, protesters are continuing to loudly shame U.S. political cheerleaders of Israel's genocide wherever they go. In New York City, protesters disrupted an event this week featuring accomplished war hawk Hillary Clinton.
This is the national story or stories that we need to tell now.
And students at Arizona State University this week confronted blood-soaked Democratic Party elites David Axelrod and Nancy Pelosi.
Pelosi, you are complicit in genocide. The blood of over 15,000 Palestinian babies is on your hands. How can you be a Democrat and say you hold democratic values while over 100,000 innocent Palestinian civilians have been massacred with bombs that you paid for? We will not be shamed into voting for you or Genocide Joe and your massacrist policy. My family back home in Palestine is being killed. Their blood is on your hands. And David Axelrod, shame on you and every one of the Democratic elite that want to shame us for voting for Genocide Joe. 80% of Democrats support a ceasefire. Shame on you! Shame on you!
And that's just some of the news from on the ground in Palestine and across the world over the last few days. Please go to electronicintifada.net to read some of our crucial new features by writers in Gaza, now up on our homepage. And you're watching and listening to the Electronic Intifada live stream. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman with Ali Abu Nima. Coming up, we'll get a full update from John Elmer on the latest military developments in Gaza. But first, Ali, I know you wanted to send some special Eid greetings.
Yeah, I want to say Eid Mubarak, kul am wa antum bkhair to everyone who's observing Eid today and in the coming days. We received many lovely messages from readers and viewers. And this morning I spent some time sending and receiving Eid messages on WhatsApp from many of our contributors and friends in Gaza. And it was very moving that they are unbowed. They're going through terrible days, and many of their wishes were for better days in the future that we hope and pray will come. But I just want to say here to all our friends and loved ones and colleagues in Gaza, kul amu intu bkhair. We hope and pray that next year will be, the next Eid will be an Eid of celebration, of healing, of togetherness, of justice, and victory.
Yeah, exactly. Eid Mubarak. Well, before we go to John, Ali and I interviewed journalist and author Anthony Lowenstein about Israel's use of surveillance technology and artificial intelligence during its genocidal attacks on Gaza. This was pre-recorded because of the time difference in Australia, but let's go to that interview. Barbaros Friedman with Ali Abonima. We wanted to dive into the topic of Israeli weaponry and specifically the use of artificial intelligence and facial recognition technology being used by Israel's genocidal army and sold by Israel on the market to other states.
Our colleague Michael Brown wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago about the Israeli military's use of facial recognition to collect information about Palestinians in Gaza using tech from CoreSight, a private Israeli company. Michael writes that, quote, Israel's apartheid army detained, interrogated, and beat Palestinian poet Mus'ab Abu Toha, a graduate of Syracuse University, with the assistance of CoreSight's facial recognition technology. Other Palestinians have been similarly detained via CoreSight technology. Joining us to talk about this is Anthony Lowenstein. Anthony is a journalist and the author, most recently, of The Palestine Laboratory, How Israel Exports the Technology of Occupation Around the World. Anthony joined us on the Electronic Intifada podcast last year to talk about his book, and we're so pleased to have him back with us today. Welcome, Anthony.
Thanks so much for having me. Good to be back.
Thanks. Let's begin by having you talk about CoreSight, a company that Israel is currently helping battle test its products in Gaza. You've written about CoreSight in your book, The Palestine Laboratory, and you lay out how this company is, or rather lay out for us how this company is operating during the genocide that's going on in Gaza right now.
Just briefly, so CoreSight's been around for a number of years, and in the past it's worked in facial recognition with brutal police forces from Brazil and elsewhere. And as I talk about in my book, the company has also worked with various companies and individuals in the occupied West Bank to, inverted commas, perfect that technology on Palestinians. The focus then was more the West Bank. Now, fast forward, obviously, to after October 7, and both what I was hearing and reporting, but also there was that New York Times story a few weeks ago, which I guess confirmed it, although I'd heard this before that story came out, that CoreSight was working with the Israeli military alongside, I might add, Google Photos. Now, the role of Google in Israel, along with Amazon, many viewers will be aware of this, have been assisting with the Israeli military with cloud services for a number of years, and it's been a long campaign by staff of both companies to try to stop that. But what we know now is, and I'm sure viewers have seen this as well, you know, since October 7, there's often been footage and that's emerged from Gaza, which shows long lines of Palestinians walking from A to B, essentially being forcibly moved, ethnically cleansed from part of the Gaza Strip to somewhere else. And often you would see this almost sort of on stilts, this sort of camera, which we always presume was some kind of facial recognition technology, which it clearly was, almost certainly owned by CoreSight. And what they're essentially doing, I mean, the Israelis claim, nonsense, but what they claim is trying to find Hamas militants, the argument being that people are moving from point A to point B. How do we know who's in that population? Maybe there are Hamas terrorists, so they claim, amongst that population. But essentially what's happening is that huge numbers of people's details are being collected. Their data is being collected. There's no consent. And people often are being taken in and arrested and tortured by Israel, both within Gaza and in Israeli prisons, based on what? False information, misidentification. And this is what I've been hearing for a number of months, and this New York Times piece almost, I guess, consolidated that information. But it's an interesting case where I've already seen examples of CoreSight since October 7, this is before this New York Times story appeared, potentially promoting itself globally as battle-tested, showing that how effective, again, their words, it is in Gaza, and therefore trying to sell that to particularly police forces around the world. And I'd have to say that history would suggest a number of police forces, both in democracies and dictatorships, would find that very attractive.
And Anthony, you know, you use that term battle-tested. It's well known that not just CoreSite, but many, many Israeli weapons companies, like, for example, Elbit Systems, which is the biggest or one of the two biggest in Israel, market their technologies as battle-tested and battle-proven, which means tested on Palestinians and tested by murdering Palestinians. If not in this current genocide, I'm sure that's going on now, but many of the weapons that have been sold around the world would have been tested during the previous massacres Israel has carried out in Gaza, for example, in 2014. Mm. And we know that weapons, intelligence, surveillance are huge exports for Israel, and various regimes around the world, so-called democracies, as well as others, have been buying these technologies on the basis that Israel is considered to be this country with tremendous technology, tremendous prowess, tremendous capability. And that's been one of Israel's real marketing points. But what we saw on October 7th was this myth being completely imploded by the resistance, which carried out a very sophisticated, very well-planned attack all along the Gaza boundary, completely defeating this $1.5 billion high-tech fence, effectively blinding the Israeli electronic surveillance, and completely collapsing and routing the Israeli military's Gaza division. So was it all PR and marketing? And can Israel recover that reputation, or is it just damaged goods, so to speak?
I would agree with everything you've just said, but there's one important caveat. And the caveat is that although so far, obviously, we're, I'd say, only 6 months in since October 7, there's been no real accountability in any way within Israel for what happened, suffice to say. And I've been seeing lots of evidence that, in fact, the companies, including Israeli companies, including some of which were whose technology or so-called defenses were breached on October 7, are still promoting and marketing and testing in Gaza new technology since October 7. So let me give you a couple of examples. So there's been two major global arms fairs since October 7. One in Paris late last year and one in Singapore in the last couple of months. And in both cases, a lot of Israeli defense companies, Elbit and others, were there promoting certain technology, certain tools, certain drones, certain killer quadcopters, various things that have been used, not on October 7, of course, but in Gaza since, as battle-tested. I mean, they openly say so. The question I've been getting a lot in the last months is, doesn't October 7 show what Hamas did, that all this is smoke and mirrors? I mean, on one level, the answer is yes. But on the other hand, I would suggest, based on past history, that in fact, there is little evidence to suggest that Israel will not successfully market and sell huge amounts of tech they've been using in Gaza to make massive amounts of money. For example, after Russia's invasion of Ukraine in February 2022, which obviously is 2 years ago now, there was, as you guys have reported and I've covered as well, huge amounts of European states buying Israeli missile defense shields and other set of things. I see no indication, zero, that has changed since October 7. Zero. European states are still interested in buying that tech. In their worldview, Russia is obviously still in Ukraine, which it is. And that conflict is unresolved. It's like a stalemate, really. So I would argue that all those European states that have been relying and wanting on Israeli tech will continue. And secondly, briefly, I think you will see, and I've said this for a number of months, the reason why much of the Arab elite's leadership I'm talking about here have not cut formal ties with Israel. Yes, they've expressed concern and they're disappointed, all that sort of thing. I think Israeli weapons and surveillance tech is a massive part of that, a huge part of that. What I mean by that is that the last figures we have for Israel's arms industry is 2022. We should get the 2023 figures soon. I mean, this is the official figures, which are always massaged, but we haven't got the 2023 figures. We should get them in the next couple of months. 24% of the 2022 figures were Arab autocracies, a quarter. And I see no indication that any of those Arab states will be less interested in repressive tech from Israel. In fact, I would argue they want them even more, because you've seen in the last 6 months huge amounts of Arabs on the streets protesting really their own government's inaction or complicity in what Israel's doing in Gaza. So I would argue those states, their elites, are even more petrified of their own people. I mean, this to me is the underlying issue, that Arab elites are petrified of the Arab Spring Mark II. I mean, the Arab Spring was, you could argue, didn't succeed as many advocates would have wanted, for obvious reasons. But the fact is that those Arab states want that sophisticated repressive tech that Israel sells and markets and is using in Gaza. So, yes, it's possible that October 7 and the complete Israeli failure on that day should negatively impact its arms industry. But honestly, I haven't seen much evidence of that so far.
Wow.
So far. Well, yeah. Obviously, there's always that caveat, so far. And I guess we'll talk about this just briefly. Sorry, just to continue. Sorry, Nora, is that and what Israel, of course, has been doing in the last 6 months is almost trying to make everyone forget about October 7. I don't mean rhetorically. Obviously, Israel has been using October 7 as a mantra 24/7. I mean what they're doing in Gaza with weapons and surveillance tech. Facial recognition technology is a I don't think Israel's been using sophisticated drones simply as a marketing tool. They're using it in their way, so they argue, to fight Hamas. We can accept that or not, fine. But the marketing and selling of it is still a key factor. There's no doubt about that. And Israel's economy, as you guys would be aware, has taken a hit, as you'd expect, after 6 months of war. And even more reason why the Israeli state, I mean, you just probably saw in the last 24 hours, it's worth saying, Naftali Bennett, the unbelievably right-wing, racist former prime minister who has aspirations to be prime minister again, put out this long tweet, which I think is worth reading, and I'll paraphrase. It's worth people to look at this. Essentially, he says, and I think this summarizes a lot of the thinking that I'm hearing in the Israeli defense and high-tech sector. He says essentially that Israel needs to become a Silicon Valley Sparta. That's his words, not mine. October 7 was a disaster. I'm paraphrasing him. October 7 was a disaster for us. We were caught asleep. Hamas essentially overtook us. We were weak. What we need to do now is gather ourselves and become a global leader again and become a Silicon Valley Sparta. Now, it's pretty obvious what that means. And I think there are a lot of people in the Israeli political and defense sector who would share that view and will attempt to enact that. I guess we'll see how successful that is. But I think that thinking that he expresses is actually is pretty common.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see in the months and years ahead how realistic that is, given that already prior to October 7th and the genocide, there was a major brain drain and capital flight from Israel. Israel markets itself as this Silicon Wadi, as they call it. But often any successful Israeli startup would quickly leave the country and the talent too. So we'll see how realistic.
I guess it depends on that front how strong a pull patriotism is, so-called patriotism, right? That the idea that a lot of what I'm hearing from certain people I'm speaking to in the Israeli defense or tech sector is that, and this is not everybody, but a number of people feel almost a patriotic duty to stay in Israel, I mean, and market and sell those tools to help the Israeli economy. Now, is that enough people? Who knows? But some will.
Yeah. Well, speaking of some of those weapons, just as someone who researches this and has been for years, you know, thinking about the CoreSight facial recognition cameras, I mean, in the first couple months of the genocide, I remember there were stories of, you know, when they were dividing the north of Gaza from the south, they set up a massive checkpoint and forced Palestinians who were fleeing the north to move through these like containers that had facial recognition scanners attached to them. So we have that. It's unclear whether that was specifically CoreSite or a different surveillance tech company, or you know, these armed quadcopter drones that we're seeing. I mean, during the siege on Al-Shifa Hospital, during the siege on Al-Amal Hospital, during the siege on Nasser Hospital, we saw these quadcopter drones, not just armed and shooting patients and doctors and medical staff and, you know, aid workers inside the hospitals, but also they were outfitted with obviously cameras and loudspeakers so that the Israeli drone operator, wherever they were, either, you know, somewhere close by in a tank or in Tel Aviv or wherever, could use the loudspeaker as well. I mean, what kinds of weapons did we see, have we seen during this genocide that are now being marketed to other states? What's specific about the last 6 months that that you've really taken notice of in terms of the kinds of weapons here?
There's been a handful that have really struck out to me. And yes, there's obviously been drones that have been used by Israel and the US for decades and other states, but particularly since October 7, there's been a real expansion of the kinds of drones that Israel's been using. Some of them have existed before October 7. They didn't suddenly get designed on October 8th, but they're being put into use, into battle, essentially. Some of these, again, there's been a form of suicide drones that existed for years. Israel has marketed and tested those for a number of years. But there's been interesting new forms of a form of suicide drone. They don't call it that, but that's essentially what it is. The quadcopter is a good example of that, Nora, because for years, as I document in the book, in the West Bank for Palestinians, and indeed often when certain Israeli leftists have been protesting in the West Bank, they've had Israeli drones above them issuing instructions, you know, leave the area immediately. Now, obviously, Israeli Jews in the West Bank are normally not killed by drone. There have been exceptions, not by drone, but obviously Israelis can be killed, where Palestinians, of course, as we know in Jenin and elsewhere, often are killed by drone. Although I think that inevitably is going to start changing. I mean, the idea that somehow Israeli Jews are protected, so to speak, within Israel or Palestine, which was generally the case for years. Of course, there are exceptions. There's been Israelis who have been killed and injured, of course. But in general, I think that'll change, where there is quite clearly a growing war on Israeli leftists, but then that's a slightly separate issue. The one I think that stands out the most to me is AI-enabled warfare. And I wrote in my book that AI has been used by Israel in Gaza for a number of years. It's massively exploded in this war, and I'm sure you guys have talked about and you've seen a couple of reports that have come out in the last months by in 972 magazine, which the people I'm speaking to have roughly backed up that reporting.
This is but by Anthony, if you, we've seen the reports, and I'm sure a lot of our viewers have, but can you just explain very in very simple terms what it is? Yeah.
Essentially, what these tools that they're using, they being Israel, they called names like Lavender, The Gospel, Where's Daddy? I mean, where to even begin with those sort of titles? Essentially, they are gathering massive amounts of data. This data is coming from either human intelligence Israel has gained over the years, pre-October 7 and since. U.S. intelligence has, as you may recall, soon after October 7, had warships just off Israel, intelligence gathering from there. I've also done reporting through Declassified Australia, the site that I have, at Pine Gap, which is a major U.S. military base in the center of Australia. You could not be further away from the Middle East than there. The U.S. is gathering massive amounts of intelligence from that military base and sending it to Israel. So Israel's gathering all this intelligence, so-called intelligence. And what those reports essentially said was that the aim was to, so they claim, go after Hamas operatives, regardless of how low level they may be. Now, the impact of that decision, though, was that if there was going to be a, inverted commas, Hamas operative killed, it did not matter if there were dozens and dozens and dozens of Palestinian civilians killed at the same time. And this is also what I'm hearing as well. And there's one key line that comes up in that report, which is an Israeli intelligence official says that our aim was revenge. Now, obviously, a blind person could see what's been happening in Gaza is based on that. But the decision to target a building, a home, in most of those cases, particularly in the first 3 months of 2023, had very little to no human oversight. In other words, the system is gathering all this intelligence, again, so-called intelligence, all this information, and it's pumping out tens of thousands of targets. This home, this building, this mosque, this school. And it's worth saying, although maybe obvious to viewers who are watching this, that how Israel defines a Hamas operative is pretty problematic, to put it mildly.
Well, it's pretty loose, I think.
Loose, to put it fast. That's a polite way.
Just to create an analogy that I've heard someone else make, I don't claim an original authorship over this, but if you think about Hamas is a major political organization, it's dominant in Gaza, so literally everyone knows somebody who is connected in some way with Hamas, and that connection, the person who's connected to Hamas may not be connected at all to their military wing.
Absolutely.
They may be connected to the to a social service agency or to any kind of social institution. But but anyone with any connection with Hamas or with that person, whether they're a family member, a friend, a neighbor, someone who provides a service to them, could be considered fair game by this AI system. So the analogy that I heard was if someone said that this AI system is going to be used to say to destroy the Democratic Party in the United States, and then you're going to, like, this computer system is going to spit out a list of names of so-called Democratic Party operatives. It could be anyone who's ever voted for the Democratic Party, someone who's ever gone door knocking for a Democratic candidate, someone who's a local official in the smallest municipality, and so on and so forth. So basically, you're saying that literally anyone could be targeted. Yeah. I mean, people have been talking about, you mentioned 972 magazine, and they've revealed a lot of information. This is an Israeli leftist or leftish magazine. But they're calling it a flawed system. Like, in other words, this system is not working the way it should. Whereas the way I see it, and I want you to react to this, is that the system is working exactly as it's intended, because the purpose is not to actually identify so-called Hamas operatives, even members of the military wing, but to provide a justification for killing as many people as possible.
Yeah, look, I've seen also that. I mean, I can't really comment on, what 972 has said in various places. But, I mean, my view about this is that the AI systems, are working exactly as planned. And I've seen this existing before October 7 elsewhere in the world, where the whole rationale behind AI-enabled warfare that the US and Israel has made for years is pinpoint targeting. We're just going to go after the terrorists. We're not going to get civilians. So-called collateral damage, the term which I think is offensive beyond belief, will be minimized. It's all nonsense. Look at what's happening in Gaza, obviously. And I think it's also worth saying that the impact, though, of this kind of warfare. There's a story in Nikkei, the Asian news service, literally 2 weeks ago, which I wrote about, which found that, unsurprisingly, Israel is already promoting AI-enabled warfare to a global market at arms fairs and elsewhere. In other words, it's working exactly as planned in Gaza. The aim is mass destruction. That is the point. And the thing that I keep coming back to over and over again, which the report doesn't talk about because it's not its mission, is this is sort of obvious to say this, but none of this causing mass destruction is making the life of Jews, let alone Israelis, so much more unsafe. It's just insanity. Like this idea somehow that when the US was fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan, there was this geographical comfort. It wasn't next door. It wasn't Mexico. None of it justified what they were doing, of course, but it wasn't on their doorstep. The idea somehow at the end of this, whenever that happens, that Israelis, talking about Israeli Jews, are going to feel safer. I mean, you and maybe we obviously know that's obviously not the case, but that aspect of this conversation is so missing. It's absurd. I just find that lack of perspective, because of paranoia, because of revenge, because of bloodlust, because of the political atmosphere, because of racism, all the anti-Palestinianism which we know exists in Israel and much of the Jewish diaspora, sadly, not entirely anymore, but too much so. It's so counterproductive. So what worries me finally is that this justification for using AI to have a cleaner war, in fact, achieves the opposite. And just one final point on this. Of course, since 9/11, when the US was in Iraq and Afghanistan, they were often targeting people who had mobile phones, right? Person X had a mobile phone in Kabul, in Baghdad. They were seen as a terrorist. They were taken out. I'm hearing in Gaza exactly the same thing is happening. So this is part of AI, but also partly the idea that person X is seen to be a Hamas militant. Maybe let's argue that's possibly true, but they pass their phone to somebody else or they give it to their kid or they give it to their friend. Who knows? But that person therefore is targeted with dozens and dozens of civilians around.
And that's very common. I can tell you that it's very common, even before this genocide, that people buy and sell SIM cards.
Absolutely.
So,
you
know, you might have someone's number and then after a few months you call them and it's someone else completely who picks up that phone is no longer theirs. And of course, in this time of genocide, you know, working phones are at a premium. So people may be sharing phones, they may be selling, you know, they may be as a service letting people use phones for a little bit of money and so on. So all that is very well taken. And we know that that the phones are used to target people and to track people, and people consider them to be almost targeting devices because Israel can access the entire cell phone network.
Yes.
But I mean, just again, to look at the bigger picture here, because a lot of the reporting and the discussion of the AI has not surprisingly looked at the horrifying detail of this, the idea that computer programs are spitting out lists of names of people who are then being targeted, and not just them being targeted, because they say so-and-so, who the computer program has identified as a so-called Hamas operative, lives in this apartment building with 100 other people, and we're going to drop a 2,000-pound bomb on the apartment building. And that's what's been going on systematically. That's why there is so much destruction and so much killing in Gaza. But again, I want to just make the point about the bigger picture here, that all of this technical detail and horror can, in a sense, make us miss the forest for the trees, which is that after 6 months, Israel has achieved nothing in terms of its stated military goals. The unstated goal is killing and ethnic cleansing and revenge. But the stated goal is to destroy Hamas as a military and political organization and to bring back the Israeli prisoners of war and captives who are in Gaza, and they've achieved none of that. So again, do you think, I mean, it's one thing for hype and marketing for Israel to say, look at our brilliant technologies, but if you're in a defense ministry in a Western country and you're responsible for spending the money, aren't you going to look at this and say, well, I mean, it's a lot of hype?
It's a good question. I've seen not much evidence of that yet. Again, the caveat is always yet. Everything you say is correct. I mean, completely correct. But again, when we talk, for example, just to go back to the Russia-Ukraine situation, all the European countries that were buying all that missile defense shield and other tech, I don't see any evidence they're going to stop buying it because of October 7 or the last 6 months, apart from the fact that most European states have supported Israel throughout the whole thing, as we know. I don't see any evidence that the Arab states that still rely on repressive tech, as I said before, will stop buying it. I don't see that. I don't see any evidence that they would. Now, you're absolutely right. The stated goals have been a catastrophe. Israel hasn't achieved any of them. It's hard to see how they will. But again, look at the analogy with the US post 9/11. Iraq and Afghanistan were a catastrophic failure and human rights catastrophe in every way. The American defense sector has never been more successful. It's had no impact whatsoever. In fact, it's had the opposite effect. Now, I'm not saying every analogy is perfect, but the fact that Israel is failing miserably on its own ambitions, to me, does not necessarily mean that the people who are spending money in Riyadh or Phnom Penh in Cambodia, where apparently there's increasing interest in many
Or Helsinki
states,
or Stockholm or The Hague or
Well, The Hague would be nice. Yes.
Well, yeah.
I know what you mean. Yeah. I mean, it's look, I'm sure, look, anyone who's sensible will maybe have those conversations about saying, well, how effective is this technology? But, yeah, I mean, look, I've seen no evidence for it so far. I don't know what to say beyond that. And it's on one level, it's bewildering. On the other hand, the mission often is mass destruction, and many other nations admire that Israel can do that. And one thing I should say, which I say in the book consistently, is many other nations for decades have often come to Israel and asked for advice how to get away with it. This is such a key point, right? Now, is Israel getting away with it in Gaza? Well, yes, of course they are. I mean, we could argue about global public opinion, the potential of sanctions. I agree with all that. But in terms of Israel hasn't stopped, we're 6 months in, they've killed, what, 40,000? We don't even know how many people have been killed. No one's stopping them, really. So far, and many other nations, including, I would argue, states that have been publicly appalled with what Israel is doing, will still end up buying some of those weapons and repressive tech. We all know that.
It's stunning, but no, that, I mean, that makes sense. It's like they see, you know, how destructive this kind of tech can be, even if it fails to protect the ones using it sometimes, it's still, you know, the most, you know, it's a major global market product.
I should just say one thing. I mean, yeah. When I say that, people might think, gee, that sounds, there's no silver lining. I think the last 6 months, though, have brought up, and which obviously many people with EI and others have talked about arms embargoes for years, there will be some states that will try to impose some. I don't know who that will be. Maybe South Africa. It's not going to be America or the UK or Australia, of course, but some will. And some will. And that's something, in other words, I'm not saying every single country simply is blinded by the so-called brilliance of Israeli repressive tech. I don't think that. But I think you and I know that in the coming months and years, Israel will try and spend huge amounts of money to sell how, inverted commas, effective their repressive tech has been.
Right, right.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
I just wanted to say, I think it's worth mentioning that just last week, the UN Human Rights Council voted by 28-6 to call for an arms embargo on Absolutely. Israel. And of course, there's no surprise as to who the handful of no votes were. There were some abstentions, but the handful of no votes, not surprisingly, included the United States and Germany. The abstentions also included the Netherlands and France and other close allies of Israel. But we've seen other countries, for example, a court in the Netherlands ordered that country to stop shipping spare parts to Israel. Yeah. And of course, we just in recent days, we saw the International Court of Justice hearing the case of Nicaragua versus Germany. And one of the demands of Germany is, excuse me, one of the demands of Nicaragua is that the court order Germany to stop shipping arms to Israel. Of course, we're talking about Israeli arms exports, but I think it's important to remember that the arms trade goes in both directions.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, without American, and most people don't know this, maybe they do, your audience, but Germany is the second biggest arms provider to Israel, and they've sent massive amounts of arms, even in the last 6 months. People often don't know that, but it's huge.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, your point about, you know, is Israeli tech is going to keep being on the world market unless it is stopped by arms embargoes. And I mean, it's just, it's you know, and also I think about the way that that AI is in this, you know, Israel is trying to kind of, you know, massage AI and saying, well, you know, when the computer gives us these, you know, kill lists, then and then it, you know, enacts these killings on people that it has identified, then it you know, Israel is trying to absolve itself as the human military. Is this something that international law seems meaningless sometimes in cases like these, but does AI exist in a realm that is kind of a gray area for international law when Israel is finally tried at The Hague for the genocide that is that it has been orchestrating? Like, where does AI fit into that, and do you think that could contribute to something like, a kind of a global shift in how weapons companies are using this technology?
Many international law experts that I spoke to about this, not just in the last 6 months, but before, have said that at the moment, at least, there is a degree of gray area, not because international law supports mass killing of people.
Yeah.
But and this has come up an issue in the past years around even spyware, which is a far less destructive weapon, or even drones. When was the last time you saw a major American drone pilot put before The Hague? Never. And obviously there's been drone killings in Iraq and Afghanistan, elsewhere, and Syria.
But we've never seen a conventional American pilot put before The Hague either.
Indeed. Anyone. Completely. Absolutely. Yeah. Anyone. For sure. I mean, to me, there is and I've seen some attempts to accelerate the conversation around almost updating international law to accommodate. Ultimately, there's a human behind this system. Of course there is, more than one person. There's a whole team of people that obviously are feeding in the information. That information is coming from somewhere. Information is coming, for example, from whether it's Pine Gap in the center of Australia or American warships in the Mediterranean. So at the moment, there are a number of international lawyers that I know that are trying to push the UN and others to accelerate almost the drafting to update laws because of what we're seeing in Israel and Gaza, because the fear always is that this proves, inverted commas, proves the point that if Israel gets away with that, the mass killing in Gaza, which is not just through AI, of course, but partially, then other states inevitably will follow, as they will. I don't know which ones will, but I could imagine there are various other states that I'm hearing that have expressed real interest in a massively sophisticated system that in some ways, I mean, depends what you define as massively sophisticated. I mean, it's a mass killing machine, essentially, under the guise of automation, but automated killing, which has a lot of appeal. And you're seeing that more. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, there are some things that worry me about this. I mean, apart from the obvious things. I mean, for example, Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, reacted to some of the reports coming out about how Israel is using these AI, artificial intelligence systems, to compile lists of targets that, you know, is apparently, there's no intelligence in it. It's pretty much indiscriminate. It's like taking the phone book. We don't have phone books really anymore, but
I remember that. I'm old enough to remember phone books.
Those of us old enough to remember the phone book, it's like saying, here's the phone book and that's your list of targets. Ultimately, that's what it amounts to. There's very little intelligent about it. Yeah. But what Antonio Guterres said, and I'm I'm quoting here. He says, I've warned for many years of the dangers of weaponization of artificial intelligence and reducing the essential role of human agency. AI should be used as a force for good to benefit the world, not to contribute to waging war on an industrial level, blurring accountability. And I worry about that statements like that, Anthony, because there Guterres appears to be expressing concern about the artificial intelligence. But what he's saying, in a sense, is we won't be able to tell who did the crime. But to me, it's no less obvious who did the crime. Israel did the crime. Its leaders did the crime. Anyone who was involved in designing or operating this system did the crime. And I'm going to make an analogy that I make no apology for making, but this artificial intelligence is similar.
Good evening. It's 6 o'clock and you're listening to Upstage on CKUT 90.3 FM and at CKUT.ca, the show about theater on the radio, from JAMA to musicals to burlesque to comedy and everything in between, professional, student and community productions in and around Montreal, the island also known as Jurjage in the Ganiagaha language and Muniag in Anishinaabemowin, where we spell theater with an R-E at the end in both French and in English. I'm your host, Sarah De A, live in studio on Thursday, April 11th, 2024. I was off last week. We were going to take a break, but then I got super sick. And so I feel so grateful to be back in studio, feeling healthy and spry and getting to talk with you this evening. We have a lot coming up. It's kind of nice to mention that we started this week with a once in a lifetime eclipse. We close it out with April showers, but rain or shine, there is stuff that you can see this weekend in theater. And we're also looking ahead to next week, very busy calendar ahead. I'll tell you about two shows happening this weekend, but just to let you know who is coming up tonight. Powerhouse Ojibwe playwright Drew Hayden Taylor and Diane Marie Bridge on their work on Infinitheater's new play, Open House, which uses real estate to ask big questions about comparing oneself to others, either on the individual or group level. They'll be our first guests this evening. And you know, a flock of birds, it's mesmerizing to see them flit through.